Well, thank you for your welcome, Phil and Stuart and others. It's good to be here. Just to put you out of your misery, to figure out my accent, I'm a Kiwi by birth. I'm based in Auckland, but I'm a Mish kid from India, married an American, studied in the States, so as a bit of a mixed up kind of person. So it's lovely to be here, and also with some of the folk that we work with in the Pacific. And as Wendy has said, we're going to have 2 or 3 days together. One of the things I really enjoy in the training that we do is a session where we get people to reflect on their own context, because it's hard for me to do that, traveling to lots of countries. And in Myanmar, just 3 weeks ago, I wrote down by translation, I'm not expecting you to be able to see all this, but this is what I wrote down as the folk from Myanmar reflected on their context. Because good preaching not only opens the word, it opens the world in which people live. And these were the top issues that the folk in Myanmar mentioned as key to their context. Let me just read them to you. Racism towards ethnic groups. Lack of good governance in the country, in practice a dictatorship. The lack of protection for the rights of citizens. Poor infrastructure like roads. Freedom of religion is not really true. And there's a lack of jobs. Now, a list like this is true in country after country in Asia Major in the 21st century. So some of the ones that I would visit: Sri Lanka, Cambodia, China, Pakistan, Indonesia, Thailand. It's true of all those countries, this sort of a list in some shape or form. And you know, it was true also for the people living in Asia Minor in the first century, the people to whom Peter is writing here in chapter 2. And these people are actually living in a within a system that is actually set against the purposes of God. And that's why Peter is writing, to help them live in that kind of world. And in these verses that Phil has read, the spotlight goes on, what does it mean to be the church in that kind of world? What should the church look like when it lives within a system that is set against the purposes of God? And in this passage, I want to suggest to you that Peter provides three pictures of the church. And the first picture in verses 4 to 6 has written underneath it, if you like, the caption, "Building on Christ." And maybe the artists and the visual ones among you might like to sketch a picture as you listen that brings that caption to life, "Building on Christ." Now, it's interesting because the name of Jesus is actually only mentioned once in these verses. The passage seems to be more interested in stones than it is in Jesus. There's a living stone in verse 4. There's a cornerstone or capstone in verse 6. And there's a stumbling stone in verse 8. But on closer examination, each one of those stones refers to Jesus. Let's take a closer look. Jesus is the living stone. Verse 4, as you come to him, the living stone. Who is Peter talking about? Well, you need to just go back to verse 3, and it's Jesus. The living stone is Jesus. This is the stone over which the craftsman takes care. It's not a rough and random rock from the field. It is precious to God, and it is chosen by him. And it is a stone to which all God's people come. As you come to him, the living stone, jump to verse 5, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house. Then, staying with the picture of a house, Jesus is also the cornerstone, a very important stone, placed where the different walls meet, placed at just the right angle to ensure that the building is stable and the foundation is strong. And with this stone, we read that first God considers this Jesus to be precious. And then they, the people of God, come to share God's opinion on his Jesus in verse 7. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious. Jesus is the living stone to which they come. Jesus is the cornerstone which they consider to be precious. But this passage is not just about Jesus being celebrated as precious. Peter's readers are living in a world with people who reject Jesus. They live within a system that is set against the purposes of God. And Peter knows this. And so he reminds them also that Jesus is the stumbling stone. Not everyone comes to Jesus. Not everyone considers him precious. Some people find Jesus to be a stumbling stone. They do not believe him. They disobey him. And when you keep doing that, Jesus becomes an obstacle over which you fall. And they reject him. And Peter adds these incredibly sad verses at the end of verse 8. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But, you know, the English translations disguise something in these verses, something very important. In working with the various extremes of choosing and rejecting, of believing and disbelieving, the language in this passage is of honor and shame. The very language which resonates so strongly within the cultures of Asia. In fact, the word for honor is mentioned 9 times in this letter. At their core, these verses are about the divine honoring of Christ, the divine honoring of believers, and the divine shaming of unbelievers. So, for example, take the drug scandal that is hitting sport down under. The conversation at the moment is all about who is guilty, and so it should be. But when the concept of sin and wrongdoing starts to disappear, as it has tended to do, being guilty doesn't really quite carry the stigma that it once did. If all of this was going on in Asia Minor or Asia Major, something more significant would be happening. The question that would be being asked is, who is being shamed? Which family is being dishonored by this scandal? Which tribe? Which club? And that would be a weightier and more significant issue for many cultures. And so for churches battling today within systems set against the purposes of God, this picture of building on Christ brings such encouragement. It speaks of a solidarity with Christ. You know, in our worlds and our churches, the phrase which is most commonly used to describe a Christian today is following Christ. Now, that's true, but really, it's not true enough. It's not the whole picture. The solidarity described in Paul's being in Christ, the solidarity described in Peter's building on Christ, that too is required. There is actual connecting to Christ, not just a following of Christ. Christianity is the only faith where followers are united with the founder. He is a living stone. We are living stones connected to Christ. And in these verses, there's also a solidarity with each other as we celebrate being the household of God. The image of family is common in 1 Peter, a letter, ironically, which stresses about how they are the alien and the stranger. The point being that there is a belonging for those who do not belong. There is a home for the homeless. The rejected ones are actually elected ones. In the church, we have parents and children, brothers and sisters, aunties and uncles in the faith. And belonging to such a community when the stress goes on is significant. For churches battling today within systems set against the purposes of God, solidarity with Christ and solidarity with each other is huge. Building on Christ and then building into each other is what is required. But then there's a second picture, and it comes in verses 9 and 10. And underneath, if you like, is written the caption, another picture for you to draw, belonging to God. And Peter includes here so many pictures to describe this belonging. If you include verse 5, there are 6 pictures, and each one is worth its own meditation. In verse 5, a spiritual house and a holy priesthood. Now in verses 9 and 10, a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And it's as if Peter is grasping for some way to sum it all up. We are truly a people belonging to God, God's very own treasured possession. And with these truths, the mood of the passage has changed. The transition from verse 8 to verse 9 is one of the most sudden transitions in the New Testament. Now the mood is one of celebration. And all around the world, you know, we hear people sing "Amazing Grace." How sweet the sound. Well, in these verses, I think we find "Amazing Mercy." How sweet the sound. And "Amazing Community." How sweet the sound. Let's take a closer look. "Amazing Mercy." You know, the experts think that this letter was written to Gentiles and not to Jews. But that raises a very big question. Why is Peter using so many Jewish images if it's not for a Jewish readership? Why is he bringing to mind so many Old Testament ideas and pictures? There are as many as 6 different Old Testament passages overheard in these 2 verses. Is not effective communication about using pictures and illustrations to which people can identify? This is really odd. But see, here is amazing mercy at work, because God is saying all of this is for you too, Gentiles. What else could verse 10 possibly mean? Once you were not a people, now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. They belong to God. How amazing mercy. How sweet the sound. And it's kind of like is the case with online, you know, blogging and articles. The Gentile Christian story becomes embedded within the story of Israel as they are given Israel's identity as a way to bring hope and reassurance. And then there is amazing community. If amazing mercy is uncovered when we note that these readers are Gentiles, then amazing community emerges when we note that these Gentiles are living in no single location. The first 2 verses in chapter 1 make it clear that this letter went to readers scattered through various provinces in Asia Minor. They are not living in a single location. It's an unusual letter in the New Testament. Very important. They are scattered throughout Asia Minor. But then how does Peter describe them? House, priesthood, people, nation, all of those involve more than one person. There's no focus on individuals here at all. These are collective words, but there's more. It's not houses, priesthoods, nations. There is just one of them. There is no focus here on individual communities at all. These scattered readers are just the one people belonging to God. It would be like sending a letter to individuals in specific churches in Toowoomba, Rockhampton, Cairns, Mackay, and I have to add Thursday Island because that's where my dad was born, and referring not to them as churches in these scattered locations, but the church, singular. Just one of them. It's profound. Amazing community. How sweet the sound that reaches beyond the individual person and even beyond the individual congregation to include all and everyone into one church. And in learning how to live within a system that is set against God's purpose, it is this collective which is needed. These churches in Asia Minor are one single church in the first century. Nothing has changed. the churches in Asia Major in the 21st century are to be one single church. And maybe Paul's words to a local church can have a kind of a continental projection, where the parts that seem weaker become indispensable, and those that seem less honorable are treated with special honor, and where one part suffers, every part suffers with it. Now, many leave this passage here. Our NIV seem to want us to leave this passage here by starting a new section. They think that the key teaching on the church finishes here, gathering to build on Christ and to belong to God. But the church is not just about gathering. It's also about scattering. And verses 11 and 12 of chapter 2 are the transitional verses in this letter. They are the bridge between the belief and the behavior. And in introducing this shift, they start by naming these readers again as aliens and strangers, drawing together the different words used in verse 1 and verse 17 of chapter 1, and interestingly, the same two words used of Abraham in Genesis chapter 23. As it was true for the believer Abraham 2,000 years earlier, so it is true for believers in Asia Minor in the first century and Asia Major in the 21st century. They will tend to have, as one person puts it, a minority status void of power and prestige. Last year I met a 50-year-old man in Pakistan who reckons he's never had a proper job only and simply because he is a Christian. A minority status void of power and prestige. Under that kind of pressure, in a system so set against God's purpose, and in light of these truths about building on Christ and belonging to God, the question to ask is, how then do we live? How do these people live as they scatter into the world? And the age-old questions emerge in Asia Major in the 21st century, just as they did in Asia Minor in the first century. Is it about withdrawal and escaping? Is it about being anonymous and disappearing? And is it about assimilating? The big questions that have always been with the church. And Peter's response in the final picture has written underneath it the caption, intriguing the world. Because in the following chapters, the rest of this letter about submission and suffering, the focus remains on the life of doing good. They are to live exceptional lives when they scatter into the world. Lives which make people curious and intrigue them. Now, in general terms with these verses, Peter does seem to be taking an old song and remixing it as a new artist. He was with Jesus during the Sermon on the Mount and heard about the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And these verses kind of recycle those truths. Being the light means being set apart from the world. Like light is different from darkness, showing the way to a darkened world. Verse 11 is also about being different, about being distinctive, where he says, as foreigners and exiles, abstain from sinful desires. Being the salt, then, means mixing into the world. It's not so much being separate and different. It's about getting involved and mixing and participating in the world, helping to prevent the world from going rotten. And in verse 12, we have that same instinct. Live such good lives where? Among the pagan. Mix in with them and live with them. Participate and be involved. For Jesus, this is the way to influence the world. To be involved, but in a way that remains different. Salt and light. Intrigue them. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder what you are. Intrigue the unbeliever. Then in specific terms, with his readers in mind, Peter has his own personal challenge for them in intriguing the world. Verse 11 states it negatively. Verse 12 states it positively. In verse 11, there is a war to be won. The war occurring at our own sinful desires. When people start building on Christ, when people start celebrating belonging to God, the old temptations do not turn off like a tap. The struggle remains. There's always a battle and a battlefield. It's called growing in holiness. And we know there's a corruption out there in the systems set against the purposes of God all around Asia Major. It is the first word on everyone's lips. Our country is corrupt. But Peter reminds readers that the epicenter of corruption is the individual human heart. Its cravings belong to a former way of life, and it intrigues people that we no longer live in that way. And then from verse 12, there is a life to be attractive. The word good comes up twice. It's a bit boring and bland, the word good. I think the idea is of a life that appeals with a kind of magnetic quality, that makes people ask questions and intrigues them, even to the point of seeing them entangled in the ways of Jesus. Earlier this month, I was in Sri Lanka, sitting in the office of a leader of the church in that country. Sri Lanka is climbing up the list of favorite tourist destinations, but behind the scenes, the country's a mess. On February the 3rd, just 2 weeks ago, the bishop had called for a national day of lament. Very powerfully. Because Sri Lanka has its own killing fields waiting to be dug up. On the Friday, I drove through the streets of Colombo with an elderly man who wept at the wheel as he spoke of things that he had seen and of truths that have yet to be spoken, and the nervous breakdown that he narrowly avoided as a result. The president has systematically set up a government that has a form of democracy but denies its power. And this church leader looked me in the eye and said, "We no longer have a democracy, we have empire." And I asked him, "What does the church do in such a circumstance?" He said to me, "Live in revelation, learn the art of subversion, and do it in a way that is attractive and intrigues people." The very same approach which brought the Roman Empire to its knees. And all round Asia Major, the church needs to be in gathering mode. Oh, yes, it does. Building on Christ, belonging to God, but also in scattering mode. And the only option that they have, certainly not like the U.S., where they can seek political power. They ain't got that option. But simply by intriguing the world from the margins. Now, I hope something has bothered you about this message this morning, if you've been listening carefully. Here I am in Brisbane, and I'm going on and on about Asia Major. Come on, Paul, make it relevant to us. Apply it to us here in Brisbane. Well, it's all been very deliberate. Friends, you know, we travel through life hearing our politicians and our economists and our business leaders going on and on about Asia and how we need to strengthen ties with Asia. They'd have free trade agreements with every single country in Asia, if they could. Where does the church sit with all of this? What about the ties that bind churches across Asia and here down under as well? Because you see, these same leaders go on about the global village. But friends, a consequence of the global village is that there is a village church. That's the consequence. Across from your Aussie hut is a Pakistani hut. Just up the path is the Myanmar hut. Across from it is the Sri Lanka hut. And behind it is the Bhutan hut. And in the face of systems set against the purposes of God, the value of the collective, of standing together with the believers in Asia Major is significant. Yes, we build on Christ together with the believers in Asia Major. Yes, we belong to God together with the believers in Asia Major. And yes, we intrigue the world together with believers from Asia Major. Patriotism, singing out our own nation above others, patriotism is one of the great evils of our time. It works against the mission of God in the world. Why can't 1 Corinthians 12 on the body have a local, a regional, a continental, and a global protection? I encourage you, in whatever initiatives you take as a church, the truth of where the parts that seem weaker are made indispensable, where those that seem less honorable are treated with special honor, and where one part suffers, every part suffers with it.